concerned about civil rights for the poor here in Santa Cruz, across the state, across the nation, across the world, hopefully across the street. That's what's more important. With me is John Stewart, Judgment Day John, as I sometimes call him, because he should grin. Hey, our mic, are we back? Yes, we're back. We're bad. We're back.
Another one on?
Okay. Actually, we'll work on this one, and then we'll work on both of them. John is, of course, an activist for a number of different areas, both homeless rights, civil rights generally, and also the rights of those abused by the psychiatric system. And John recently called in a controversy concerning the question of just who are the homeless anyway? What kind of a population of people are we dealing with? And on the air at that time, we had community activist Brimstone Barbara Riverwoman. Excuse me. Barbara Riverwoman has been involved with the River Street Refugees, about whom more later, always more and more. That's the group that's being bounced about from campground to campground, kind of a a model or a kind of a paradigm, a moral almost, as this small group of campers who is initially... Well, part of them, a lot of people were evicted, but they were certainly some of those evicted from the only open-air shelter in Santa Cruz, the only campground, back in December. And they've been bouncing from state campground to state campground. First, compliments of Mayor Mike Rotkin and Citizens Committee for the Homeless bureaucrats, Paul Merceau and Daryl Darling, as well as hundreds of others of homeless people who are currently out in that rain out there that is coming down, hopefully not on your heads. And John called in to talk to Barbara Riverwoman, because Barbara has been putting together some proposals on her behalf. I guess there's some question as to whether they're on behalf of the River Street Refugees or whether they've all agreed on that. I guess they haven't yet. But the emergency shelter crisis is really a crisis, and particularly in this kind of weather. You can feel it if you're outside. I mean, even guys like me who usually have roofs, I haven't always had one, but usually I do. My roof leaks where I'm staying right now, but at least there are parts of the room that don't. To have a tent, to be able to cover your head when it's wet, to be able to get warm when it's cold. I mean, all these basic things, which I shouldn't even have to talk about on the air, are denied here in our city under the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban, which I bring up every show because I think it needs to be mentioned to those who haven't heard it. And to those who have, we have to keep figuring out ways to do something about it. And indeed, hopefully there'll be some pressure both from the streets when the Armory lets out on March 15th, or possibly even before then. That's when the Armory winter shelter closes down, March 15th. That's a short 2 or 3 weeks away. And also the city council has been making somewhat more, less feeble responses to the issue. Celia Scott, the most liberal council member, and Catherine Byers, a long-term good woman, but nonetheless timid person on the council, really got kind of lion-like last week over the issue of the fence, fencing off the Ford's parking lot, which was a proposal essentially to destroy the subculture of Hippie Corner, drive people away, spend $4,000 city dollars in doing it, eliminate parking spaces, all because some merchant bigots, and I call them bigots, I believe that's a real simple question of bigotry, passed that at the Downtown Commission. These are the same gang of bigots, or certainly a related group that got the city council to pass the downtown ordinances, sit on the sidewalk, go to jail, and those kinds of laws, which we are still suffering under, and which people are still being harassed and ticketed under. I was out there with my tape recorder a couple days ago, and some guy came up and says, what are these guys coming telling me not to, sit on the sidewalk? And what is all this stuff? And that's happening. That's happening. Indeed, I had a long interview with a host supervisor, Matt, who himself is somewhat sensitive about the issue of songs raised to satirize, actually to lampoon the host. That's really the word. The British word is lampoon, which means really harsh caricature of these green-shirted grinners who are actually sort of a merchant advance force for the police. And I talked to Matt about this, and Matt, kept saying, we're not the police. And I said, no, you're the eyes and ears of the police, and you can be found on police reports when they do issue citations, because you're the people they call, and you give the testimony. And you're the cops, let's face it. You're the cops without guns. You're the cops without decent pay. You're the cops without training. You're the cops who are simply sort of the reconnaissance force for the police. And that is a sad hypocrisy that our city is now suffering because, of course, the Santa Cruz does not want to alienate the public and provoke more demonstrations of the kind that rocked our streets in 1994 in May. They call these people the genial, generous, hospitable hosts. Well, they aren't the hosts. They're the advance force for the police. And it's not good, particularly when people are getting pepper gassed. I'm talking about Food Now Bombs worker was pepper gassed about a month ago. Hopefully he's worked that out with the host who did it, but I don't like the idea of people getting pepper gassed. I'm sorry, even if they do work it out, the hosts have got to work it out with the community, as far as I'm concerned. That's my feeling on that whole thing. But let's get back to John Stewart, particularly since he'll give me a chance to run out in the rain and get my tape recorder. John, you've got a couple books with you here today, A Nation in Denial, Out of Bedlam, Rachel and Her Children, and you've been doing some heavy research, I take it.
Not really. Try that mic. How come this one doesn't work?
Well, it does, actually. It does. We got mics here.
So we got two mics now.
Yeah, we got Michael Sheridan. We got, never mind. That's another matter.
Well, Barbara Riverwoman came to Robert's show last week and brought with her a book entitled Nation in Denial.
Which you have with you.
Which I have with me. The library had it. Mm-hmm. The Truth About Homelessness. And as soon as I heard the title, I'd heard about this book previously, and there'd been a newspaper report on the book and the burden of its, Robert's going to go somewhere right now, so I'm going to be left babbling at you.
I'm going to leave John at the mic. If he does anything nasty, you tell me when I get back. The call-in number is 427-3772. That's 427-FRSC. So in case you want to get in on the ground floor, get in, because the lines are open.
Well, we may have to repeat some of the stuff if Robert gets back, because I would like him to have a say about it. In any event, I have the book here. I haven't read it from front to back. I read it from the index, more or less, looking to see how it talks about us, the poor, the people in poverty, and those people in poverty who lack a certain, safe, and secure place to sleep, people who lack regular nutritious meals, people who've been more or less deprived of, from my point of view, deprived of access to jobs and housing. In any event, I want to read you the definition from this book, A Nation in Denial, of what the authors, Alice S. Baum and Donald W. Burns, say this is their definition of homelessness or a homeless person. We define the homeless as those persons whose ability to function in ordinary social and economic interactions has been so impaired by their disabling conditions that they are socially alienated from their various support networks and from society's institutions and are unable to maintain independent housing. To rephrase that so that the definition can be more clearly understood, they define homeless people as those who are so impaired by their disabling conditions that they lack the ability to function in ordinary social and economic interactions, and they are socially alienated from their various support networks and society's institutions, which is to say the cause of being homeless is their disabling conditions, which is for people writing a book entitled Nation in Denial, seems to me we have two authors in denial, denying the lack of affordable housing and denying the fact of millions of jobs shipped overseas. In any event, a further attribute of the so-called homeless is that, according to the authors, despite the diversity within the homeless population, homeless people share an important and distinctive characteristic. They are almost totally alienated from people and society's helping institutions. No doubt, but according to them, that alienation is a consequence of their disabling conditions. And what are their disabling conditions? The authors say their disabling conditions are mental illness, drug abuse, and alcoholism. Not lack of affordable housing, not lack of jobs, not lack of a guaranteed income. Their solution to this, to the homeless problem, is on page 127. An important initial step must be active and aggressive outreach offered in a non-threatening way, usually over a long period of time, sometimes for months, sometimes for even longer. Many homeless people are fearful of others and distrust institutions with which they have had previous negative encounters. Others seem to prefer the isolation in which they exist, or, as with the young, so-called chronically mentally ill, do not see themselves as needing help and often show contempt for traditional helping systems and traditional helpers. Outreach typically should include the dispatching of teams into areas where such people congregate to talk to them, build trust, and slowly, gently encourage them to accept the kind of help they need. That's the initial. Subsequently, they go into, I believe, they want to, basically, they want, my take on it is they want to reopen the state hospitals and fill them up with so-called mentally ill people and dual diagnosis people. If they don't, then what exactly is their, what do they want to do? So the question is, for anyone out there, if you meet someone, you're talking to someone, and you decide the someone you're talking to is mentally ill, my first question is, do you tell that person that you've decided they're mentally ill, or do you keep that hidden so that you have a covert opinion of them that you're not willing to disclose to them? My second question is, in the same vein, if you meet someone and you decide they're mentally ill, what do you decide to do about them? Do you decide you're going to help them, and do you offer them help of a psychiatric kind? And if they say they don't want your help of a psychiatric kind, what do you tell them then? Do you tell them you're going to keep coming back for 6 months on like a couple of times a week to talk to them, to bug them, to intimidate them, to talk to them about their so-called mental illness when they've told you once? How many times does anybody have to tell somebody else that they don't want their help before someone like that will go away? I've had the situation where you have to tell somebody. It's a never-ending process of telling a mental health professional you don't want their help. That's my experience, having been locked up several times. So this book's bullshit about being gentle and persistent and all that, that's just bullshit. The end result would be no doubt an expanded welfare and institutions code 5150, forced treatment, involuntary psychiatric intervention into people's lives and taking them to various kinds of locked facilities. And if they won't take their psychiatric drugs, assault them and forcibly inject the psychiatric drugs in their butt. in any event, strangely enough, this book, which purports to be about homelessness and people who are homeless and living in poverty, destitute in poverty, doesn't go into the effects of malnutrition, which is one of the consequences of being homeless. Doesn't go into sleep deprivation, which is a consequence of being homeless. Doesn't go into the effects of dream interruption, which is a consequence of homelessness. But purports it to be an as it were humane and ethical to do a street a psychological evaluation on the spot of someone who's supposedly homeless without taking those three factors into account, much less taking into account the effects of the stress of a daily existence in poverty and destitution, striving for the next meal, striving for a safe and secure place to sleep, striving to avoid the police, stressed and stressed out in every imaginable way. And I would like to add that I'm not speaking from a survey I did. I didn't go and survey the homeless people to find these things out. I didn't go observe the homeless people to find these things out. I didn't go interview the homeless people to find these things out, as the authors of this book and all the surveys they quote in there no doubt did, the academic experts, the so-called experts on homelessness, observing, interviewing, surveying us. I lived it on the streets of San Francisco in the 70s, in the early 70s. I lived it on the streets of Berkeley in the mid-70s. I lived it on the streets of L.A. in the late 70s, 79. I lived it on the streets of Santa Cruz in 78 and 81. I lived it on the streets of Washington, D.C. in 78. I've been there, done that. In any event, these people, these experts, are utterly, from my point of view, just utterly beyond belief. Let's see. A very different sort of book is a book by Jonathan Kozol entitled Rachel and Her Children, Homeless Families in America. I'd like to quote some stuff from Kozol, something on page 4 here. The chilling fact, from any point of view, is that small children have become the fastest growing sector of the homeless. At the time of writing, there are 28,000 homeless people in emergency shelters in the city of New York. An additional 40,000 are believed to be unsheltered. This book was written in 88, I believe. Let me check this out right quick. Right, copyright 88. It's 40,000. Of those who are sheltered, about 10,000 are homeless individuals. The remaining 18,000 are parents and children in almost 5,000 families. The average homeless family includes a parent with two or three children. The average child is 6 years old, the average parent 27. So our question, or my question to the authors of this book, Nation in Denial, how do you go do a psychiatric evaluation of six-year-old children and conclude that they're either mentally ill, drug abusers, or dual diagnosis mentally ill drug abusers, or alcoholics, and therefore homeless as a consequence of those things? Here's another quote. Homeless people are poor people. 4 out of 10 poor people in America are children, though children make up only 1/4 of our population. The number of children living in poverty has grown to 14 million, an increase of 3 million over 68. This is 1988. That's increased by astronomically since then. Several hundred thousand poor children, of whom 700,000 poor children, of whom 100,000 have no health insurance, live in New York City. And so on. From Jonathan Kozol, read something about available housing here. He has some statements here. Why are they without homes? That is to say, the homeless. Why are they without homes? Quote Jonathan Kozol, unreflective answers might retreat to explanations with which readers are familiar: family breakdown, drugs, cultural poverty, teen pregnancies, the underclass, etc. While these are precipitating factors for some people, they are not the cause of homelessness. The cause of homelessness is lack of housing. Listen to this. 500,000 units of low-income housing are lost every year. That's 500,000 low-income housing units are lost every year to condominium conversion, abandonment, arson, and demolition. Listen to that. 500,000 low-income housing units are lost to condominium conversion, abandonment, arson, and demolition. Between 1978 and 80, median rents climbed 30% for those in the lowest income sector. Half these people paid nearly 3/4 of their income for their housing. Forced to choose between housing and food, many of these families soon were driven to the streets. That certainly sounds to me like they were mentally ill, dual diagnosis, drug abusers, alcoholics, etc., who were disaffiliated from the institutions that helped them, and consequently, these authors of this book are, I can't stand it. Anyway, here's another quote from Jonathan Kozol on page 92 of his book, Rachel and Her Children. The use of the unrestrictive term, the homeless, is in certain ways misleading. It suggests a uniform set of problems and a single category of poor people. The miseries that many of these people undergo are somewhat uniform. The squalor is uniform. The density of living space is uniform. The fear of guards, of drugs, of irrational bureaucracy is uniform. The uniformity is in their mode of suffering, not in themselves. Let me jump over here to page 134. This is, let's see, where was that? Rather than urging the federal government to put up money, declare a national emergency and build affordable housing and institute a guaranteed income for all American citizens and totally eliminate the welfare system bureaucracy and the mental health system bureaucracy. Rather than doing that, we're told that all these children we have seen, that is to say, those who cannot concentrate in school because they are too hungry and must rest their heads against their desk to stifle stomach pains, those who sleep in pig pens, those who travel 60 miles twice a day to glean some bit of education from a school at which they will arrive too late for breakfast and may find themselves denied a lunch because of presidential cuts, must wait a little while and be patient and accept the fact that there is no quick fix for those who are too young to vote and whose defeated parents have no lobbyists in Washington or City Hall. As regards the federal housing assistance programs have been cut a full 64% since 1980. That's in 1988, and they've been cut a greater percent since then. from $32 billion in 1980 to $9 billion in the current fiscal year. In 1986, the Department of Housing and Urban Development subsidized construction of only 25,000 housing units nationally. When Gerald Ford was president, that's before 76, 200,000 units were constructed. Under President Carter, 300,000 units were constructed. So much for housing subsidies, not lack of housing, lack of affordable housing, lack of housing subsidies on the part of the government not being a causal factor in homelessness. It's utterly undeniable, and for authors of A Nation in Denial, we have, I think...
An author in denial, perhaps?
Two authors in denial.
Yes, I see.
There isn't any doubt, but... I read the definition earlier while you were out, and the definition is basically that the people who are homeless, well, let me get it out right quick. Isn't that long a definition? Well, that's not it. Well, I've lost, anyway, in any event, people who are homeless are homeless as a consequence of their disabling condition, which is said to be mental illness or so-called mental illness, drug abuse, a dual diagnosis, or drug abuse or alcoholism.
And burns in their body.
Right.
That's their claim.
And that, 85% of those so-called homeless are in that category.
Mm-hmm.
So that the consequence of these disabling conditions cause them to be disaffiliated, is their word, from the institutions that are supposed to help them, and as well alienated from the people around them.
Mm-hmm.
So in Santa Cruz, my experience of meeting people is that meeting homeless people and being homeless myself is that there are very few people who are homeless who don't have several friends.
Mm-hmm.
The ones I know are like extended family relations with their friends. I don't know what word to use for it, but they definitely are not disaffiliated from the people around them, unalienated from the people around them,
mm-hmm.
As these authors claim. You understand? What do you say? Let me find that definition right quick if I can.
Well, while you're doing that, I guess I haven't read the book. I've just...
Right.
Whenever people start talking about drug and alcohol problems, the need for programs,
right.
Homelessness being a function of that, warning bells begin to go off in my head. Now, it could be... I mean, I have a certain bias here. I mean, I know people have drug problems and alcohol problems and other things that some people... specify, you know, label them mentally ill for, as the label goes, but I think my responsibility here and the responsibility of those of us concerned with civil rights and social justice is to deal with the disparity of treatment and the basic denial of everyone's legitimate share of the world's wealth, I guess.
Right,
you know,
right,
that's the way I look at it. I guess I could be tagged a socialist or a communist in my thinking in that respect, or egalitarian or communitarian. I don't know whatever kind of words you want to use there. Again, my focus hasn't been on social services. I'm not interested, you know.
Me either.
You know, it's been on making sure that those who are trying to make it their own way don't get messed with by the authorities that be. You know?
The essential question is, to me, is given someone's definition of homeless people as disabled as a consequence of mental illness, so-called mental illness, drug abuse, and all the rest of it, and that is the cause of people being homeless, what does that imply? Does that imply that they will offer services to someone or help to someone which that person can refuse? Or does it mean that they will force treat people? And the answer
always an important question.
And the answer, of course, yeah. is, they mealy mouth it. They don't come straight out and say, "Well, we're going to force treat these people." they talk about how they will go to them and be gentle with them.
And for their own good.
And for their own good.
Right, right.
You understand? But they, and then they talk about being institutionalized in state hospitals. Mm-hmm. They skip right over the part where they ask someone, do you want our help in a psychiatric setting or an institution? And the person says no, and they say, well, you're going to get it anyway.
You know, I need to do an update on that whole issue of psychiatric rights, which I've been unable to get the psychiatric ombudsperson or the advocate to, you know, get his voice on the radio or even do much interviewing, and I hope at some point I will. Actually, John, I invited you in here because I think that it was important for you to express your view after Barb Riverwoman did a brief description of what she felt the major problem was, or one of the major problems among the homeless. And I want to turn the issue back to local politics, because I think that's really what's of most interest to our listeners, and also that's what we face out there. That's what we can do something about. And the local issue, of course, as the rain beats down harder and harder on everybody, and this morning, I'll tell you, it is wet out there, and I regret to tell you I have not found a tape recorder, so I'm going to have to either play with these tapes and go into the middle of them, or play no tapes, and we'll just babble on, the two of us, or me, and however long you can join me, John. But what I want to do is get to issues of, immediately, the issues that we're all pushing for, like ending the camping ban, ending the sleeping ban, which is the city's 11 to 8:30 ban on sleeping outdoors, providing emergency campground shelter for those who need a place to pitch their tent so they won't be arrested or hassled or falsely accused of violating the law, as people in the county are doing to those who are sleeping outside, since it's not illegal to sleep outside in the county, but sheriffs are still telling people it is. Barbara and Sherry Connable, I believe they're doing it either Barbara as an individual or Barbara and Sherry as individuals, are presenting proposals for emergency shelter, which they're kind of trying. They're hoping to kind of team up with the CCH, Citizens Committee for the Homeless, the City Council, maybe the Board of Supervisors, and get some kind of help there by kind of hoping that there is a consensus there for that kind of shelter.
Right.
What do you think about this?
I think that's all to the good. Good for them. I hope, however, that they aren't... this book and her and Barbara Riverwoman's pushing of this book and its solution to the homeless problem gives me some concern for what kind of shelter she might be advocating for. Is it a shelter with strings attached? Health system strings attached?
I saw a proposal which actually it's an interesting idea. I mean, she's the proposal that I saw last Friday had something to do with there'll be one tent, there a number of small tent circles. I think it's for 75 people, and one of them is going to be for people with drug problems, one circle. Oh. One of them is going to be for people with alcohol problems, and the rest will be drug and alcohol free. Problems anyway.
Really, that's the kind of advanced prejudicial discrimination on the part of the people running the shelter. It forces someone who wants shelter to cop a plea, as it were. The numbers of tents for the non mentally ill, for the non drug abusers and so forth, are filled up, and I come there and I want a shelter, and I don't think I'm mentally ill, I don't think I'm a drug abuser, I don't think of myself in any of those categories, but that's the only tent left, is a mentally ill drug abuser tent. So what do? I'm utterly desperate for a tent to sleep in. If I go and cop a plea, it's sort of like getting down on your knees with the Salvation Army for a meal or for a room to sleep in. If I go cop a plea as a mentally ill drug abuser just to sleep that night, I've got a damn record.
There's been a lot of getting down on your knees.
It's always that way.
It's a sad thing.
In
December, instead of campers standing up and resisting this Rotkin CCH eviction, we had campers down on their knees begging, oh, just let us stay for 2 weeks here, and we'll give up all our rights.
Right.
And that kind of thing is real easy for people to fall into when they're under the kind of pressure that campers are under. But again, I don't want to misrepresent Barbara and Sherry or Barbara's proposal. I'm not sure quite whose it is. I know it's, according to Michael Sheridan, it's not the proposal of the River Street Refugees yet, certainly. But The problem that they're having, and I noticed it, and it's a real one, is when you go to the Open Air Shelter Subcommittee, which is the City Council doodah show that meets every month and says, and checks out a few more sites and says, oh gosh, that one won't work. Actually, they found one they think will work, but it's only going to work for 40 people if they can get the money for it, if they can get someone to run it, if they can get a program, if they can get transportation. That's the De La Vega Park site. They were talking about that last week as the only open air campground to cover for the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which is closing the nearby larger, not better, but larger site, which is the Coral Street Open Air Shelter. It was suggested to me this morning, and if I can cue up Barbara's tape, you can hear the conversation I had with Barbara Riverwoman about this issue, that the campers and a lot of homeless people don't want to go back to the Back 40. Dan Hopkins has said it's a toxic site for Community House, and although he feels it should be available to people who want to camp there. They want a better place, and I agree with them, but the problem is, until you get a better place, you grab and hold on with your fingernails to what you've got, and the campers had that site. They organized around that site. It's right next to emergency shelter. It's there. It's theirs, I think, by all right, by the November 29th commitment made by the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. But
at that moment, when they were shutting down the River Street Coral Street Back 40. That was the moment, one in a whole sequence of moments that have occurred and will continue to occur in the future, which are opportunities, as Martin Luther King talks about in his letter from a Birmingham jail. There come opportunities when it's time to resist the powers that be and bring out the underlying tension that exists there, and refuse to get down on your damn knees and grovel for what crumbs the system will throw to you, but to stand as a being who has the rights as citizens of this nation, as a person, as an individual, as a group of individuals. We have rights which we should stand for. Martin Luther King doesn't say that standing for your rights is the cause of the beatings that they got down in Selma, Alabama, for example. He says that the beatings they got were the consequence of the vicious nature of the prejudice raised against them. In the same sense, if people stood for their rights at the Coral Street Shelter or Back 40, or in any future events, when we stand for our rights, as we did out there, we actually sat down for our rights that day.
Mm-hmm.
When we stand
sitting on the sidewalk, I remember 2 years
when
ago.
When we stand for our rights, what happens isn't our doing when they beat us, when they push us around, when they call us names. And the tension that brings out isn't our we're not causing that tension. Mm-hmm. The tension is there as a consequence of these people, mm-hmm, who want to control us, who rule us, who administer our lives. So the people who come then and are all concerned about the tension and what violence might occur and how we might be mistreated, they're not doing us any favors by smoothing the waters, as it were, in those situations. That's my take on it.
You know, that's well put, John. I think that a couple of things. First of all, that was the problem back in 1990 when we had massive homeless demonstrations in Santa Cruz, and some of our current leaders, like Sherry Conable, moved in and tried to remove the tension. That was her whole objective, to remove the tension, moving the demonstration away from City Hall against the sleeping ban out to the county building, making sure the demonstrators did not contact the red shirts, for instance, the anti-homeless, harsher homeless laws demonstrators that were organized by Carolyn Boozenhardt, who is now running for supervisor. The attempt to tone everything down, calm it down, quiet it down, and essentially end the protests and demonstrations. That was the whole point of the Conable Brindell faction at that time when they tried to do that 5 years ago. And I, of course, spoke against it. I thought it was a mistake. But again, it's always a really difficult question, because there are people who are taking it on the chops. Those are the people who are outside, people who are at an 8.5-month homeless table at the post office at that time. They got arrested. They got their property stolen. They got their shoes taken. They got their blankets compacted. And I guess what we have to decide here, you listeners of the radio station, who many of you are probably not homeless, many of you who have all kinds of other projects you're working on, is, and this is the question we had back in December, what kind of support? real support. And I don't just mean charity support and firewood.
Really?
You know, I don't mean money support so that we can move these people to another public campground for another 2 weeks.
Really?
I'm talking about community support that says, I'll go out there and I'll take the consequences of the kind of tension-producing resistance that we need to have here in Santa Cruz and perhaps in other places as well to get the obvious done, to get what should have been done yesterday done today, so we don't have another situation tomorrow where people are silently huddling on the streets out of the rain. And by the way, I remember back in 1989 when these generous store owners were arresting people, calling the cops, because homeless people were standing under their awnings. You know, I mean, it's a grotesque situation that needs to be fought. And interestingly enough, I think here in Santa Cruz, we have the raw material, we have the raw energy, we have the dedicated, principled people. Often who don't have the time to go to endless meetings. No, who wants to go to meetings endlessly? But who will show up for different kinds of things, who will volunteer their vehicles, who will get out there and provide food, who will assist in Xeroxing flyers. That's what we need to do. And, for example, their deadline dates are coming up soon. There's Dan Hopkins' appeal, which is a week from tomorrow. That's his appeal, the Citizens Committee for the Homeless's sellout of the homeless, the Community House Trailers Not Trolls project, as I've called it, the million-dollar project that will put 45 people in $200 to $600 a month housing, but will make sure that there's no open-air shelter on that site for the 200 to 300 people that used it last fall. That permit is coming up for a hearing before City Council. And we should be there Tuesday. That's Tuesday at City Council meeting. I'm going to give you the exact time on the next show on Friday. But actually what we need to do is organize around that. And a lot of things are going to be happening on that Tuesday. It could be a busy day for us. And you don't even have to come to the meeting. You can call the City Council, 429-3550, and say, get off your butts and establish a legal area for people to be, suspend the camping ban if you won't, or else we're going to be, you know, in your office, on your couch, sitting down there with the other 30 or 40 people who say the time for silence is over. You know, that's the kind of thing that I think would get the City Council off its doo-doo. Scott Kennedy may dismiss such calls as unproductive and counterproductive and rejected by the majority of the homeless people. He said a number of different things in his Metro letter last week about me that were critical. And let him criticize. I mean, naturally, he's going to criticize. He's a city council member who passed the anti-homeless sit on the sidewalk, go to jail laws. He's sure going to criticize that stuff. He wants to do things slowly and schmoozily and get things done at his own pace. He doesn't live outside. You know, he doesn't have to hurry on that. And perhaps, in a way, he has a sincere, let's get random this, difference of opinion on this issue as to how it can be done. Yeah, I definitely disagree with him on how it can be done. I think it gets done when people say, enough, no more, it's time to act. Now, Tuesday, John, do you want to say something about this, or shall I proceed? Anything I've been saying?
Yeah, I just want to say that the Daryl Darling trailer court that they're going to put in is in the vein of the continuing evolution of the psychiatric solution to the so-called homeless problem. Our phone is not plugged in. It's far out. If anybody's been calling in the last hour, the phone has not been plugged in. It's been sitting here on the desk unplugged. So Robert's plugging it in. And now it's ringing. No?
Still not plugged in.
Is it not?
No.
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is.
There it is.
Hello? Ooh, all right. You're on the air at Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Who's this?
I heard you had a boring meeting last night.
A boring meeting? Oh, you mean the Free Radio Santa Cruz Collective?
Somebody said they're much like the Food Not Bombs meeting.
Could well be. I was out of town, but John perhaps can brief you on the meeting. Were you at the meeting, John?
Yeah, I was at the meeting.
Well, were you in Berkeley, Robert?
What's this?
Were you in Berkeley?
I was in Berkeley.
But you missed the gathering, didn't you?
I did. This sounds like a voice from the past.
It is.
Is this town-wise Tony Mello? For heaven's sakes.
Yeah, how are you?
All right. Tony, you're one of the original founders of our Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs.
Well, I would like to report on the non-gathering in Berkeley this weekend.
Please do. I actually showed up at the gathering very, very briefly for about 5 minutes and then left.
Well, I missed you because I was there the whole time and I didn't see you, Robert.
Oh, boy. Well, we're going to have to...
Was it at Long Hall?
It was at the Long Hall. Actually, it was at the Long Hall, and then I drove some folks over to the Quaker church.
Yeah, they came in and told me you had just dropped them off.
Right, and I didn't get back. It's mea culpa. I can't stand meetings, and I usually get to meetings, particularly when I come to town specifically for
them. Well, it was a good one, because only six people showed up, so we ended it abruptly.
Oh, good.
And we decided to have a real California, not even a Northern California, but a California-wide regional gathering, March 30th and 31st, to be hosted by Fresno Food Not Bombs in Fresno. It's a Saturday and Sunday. And we haven't consensed on it yet, but... you know me, and we probably will.
Fresno is your neck of the woods.
Temporarily, yeah, until July.
You've been doing a needle exchange there, yeah.
Right.
How's that going?
It's going well. It's going well.
No problems with the police or local authorities.
None at all.
Are you in town or are you calling long distance?
No, I'm in town.
Uh oh.
I wouldn't call you long distance.
Well, it's he wouldn't.
Well,
particularly when the phone doesn't work. I'm pathetic. We can't plug in the damn phone. Have you been trying to reach us for the last hour?
No, just 2 minutes.
Oh, excellent. So we got lucky with you there.
You did well. But I wanted to make that announcement. California Regional Gathering of Food Not Bombs, March 30th and 31st in Fresno. We'll put people up. We'll have plenty of food. People don't need any money.
Are you going to leave a message here on the local line that will tell people where to go and all the specifics? And that's here in area code 408. And if you want, you can give a call to that number. And if it's not on the recorded message and you want to go to this Fresno gathering on March 30th and 31st, you can certainly leave a message and we'll get back to you on that.
And you can call long distance if you want. Area code 209-276-0101.
209-276-0101.
Right, but give me a couple of days to get home.
I don't know. We might want to keep you here for a while, Tony.
Okay.
Anything happening around Fresno that you've been both in Santa Cruz and in Fresno, and I guess other places as well. How would you compare the two scenes? They're always telling homeless people, go to Fresno. There's lots of good housing and jobs there. Is that true?
There's encampments and warm fires. And police are taking random photographs of youth. We have a brand-new Border Patrol office. We are the home of three strikes, and we're putting it to good use. And now we have the same Mike Reynolds has proposed a 10-20 life. There's a new legislation being introduced. A petition going around in all the newspapers there. They've recently introduced a curfew for youth.
That's the famous curfew that was wending its way up to the courts, which I guess is still wending its way to the Supreme Court.
Right. Mm-hmm. A couple weeks ago, they pepper sprayed numerous Fresno high school students just randomly and got some people at the bus stop there, the police did. We're still struggling around Proposition 187 in the valley. Lots of anti-immigrant sentiment. You know, we're the farmworking capital, and I think officially we have 65,000 children going to bed hungry every night in this valley where the majority of all the food is grown for all of North America.
Is that true?
We've got two juvenile boot camps under construction. City council members and county commissioners have decided to let juveniles sleep in shifts there in kind of like cocoon type. I'm not sure I understand what they're talking about, but juveniles can sleep in shifts and they don't need as many beds that way. And they're taking their food and they're going to blend it together and bake a biscuit that's pretty unattractive so that basically people will get to eat biscuits, juvenile offenders.
Well, you don't want to make it too easy for these punks, you know. I mean,
Fresno's the arson capital of the United States, I think, 2 years in a row now.
In what sense?
I mean, arson. We have more arson fires than by arson than any other city in the United States, 2 years in a row.
The arson capital of the world. So for all you firebugs, should flock to Fresno.
Fresno's the place to be. Yeah. So there's a lot of things going on, and Food Not Bombs is only serving one meal a week at this point, and we're doing a lot of food distribution. Lots of food distribution. But I hope people can get to Fresno on March 30th and 31st. We've got Naked Aggression performing on Saturday night, March 30th.
It sounds good.
And Berkeley Cop Watch will be there, too.
And what kind of activities are planned for that weekend?
Well, there'll be a presentation on use of pepper spray.
I think how to resist pepper spray or how to pepper spray back?
Pepper spray back, probably. No, actually, Cop Watch isn't into that, so we want to ban all pepper spray.
Mm-hmm.
But intergroup communications around, you know, and food not bombs is a proposed agenda item, and we definitely want to discuss the Atlanta Food Not Bombs gathering coming up in July. Mm-hmm. Some of us will be going there and about getting there and how that's going to come about. We're going to start out with chapter reports, so if people come from Santa Cruz, we want to hear all about Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
And mutual aid in the event of police repression. It looks like there's some issues around some things that could be coming up again in People's Park in Berkeley next month. When the lease expires, I think it goes back to the university, and then people are concerned about, you know, struggling with university police.
Mm-hmm.
Then also Arcata and Sacramento.
What have you heard about Sacramento? I mean, we know Arcata had six, I guess now five people are facing charges, and another person was recently arrested up there.
Right.
And what's happening in Sacramento? Just more harassment, or?
Yeah, I'm not clear about that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So all this is going to be happening next month, about a month and a week down the road.
Six weeks.
Well, this is interesting. I guess there's also some more recent stuff coming up around police abuse in the Bay Area in the next week or two. I think there's a Police Accountability Day, March 3rd, or some such thing. I wish I had the details. Maybe I do here. Let's see here. Yeah, it's Stop the Epidemic of Police Violence, National Day of Protest, 5th Anniversary of the Rodney King Beating, National Police Accountability Week, Sunday, March 3rd, meet at 16th and Mission, and march to police headquarters in San Francisco at 850 Bryant. No justice, no peace.
Right, and a bunch of us will be there from Central Valley.
So were you around the Mumia demonstrations this summer? Did you show up in the UN 50th anniversary Food Not Bombs gathering? Or?
No, I was out of the area.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Any free radio happening in Fresno?
Not yet, but if we can get some Santa Cruz people to help us, we'd really appreciate that. I'm going back in a day or so if anybody wants to ride back.
Mm. You know, you might... anybody who wants to volunteer to help Fresno do some radio can give a call to 423-HUFF, which is my phone number, and I'll kind of pass the message on to Tony here, unless you want to give your number out on the air, Tony.
Well, people can reach me in Fresno at 209-276-0101. I don't want to give out Robert's number on the air. I don't know if he wants that. But,
no problem.
But you could get him in touch with me if somebody calls you or calls the radio station.
Well, yeah, I do know people are working with free radio, and I think that, you know, it's apparently expanding like popcorn. You know,
right.
It's really good, getting big. San Jose, Pacific Grove, Salinas, a couple more in San Francisco. I mean, there's one in the Mid Bay somewhere, but I'm not sure. I think it. You've obviously got to become a DJ there, Tony. You know, a few of your songs might work wonders.
No, I'm leaving in July.
Oh, really? Where are you going?
Atlanta.
Oh, you're going off to the the worldwide hoo-ha with the Food Not Bombs thing there, eh?
Yeah, and then I'll stay gone for a while, I think.
Uh-huh. You're gonna kind of slip underground. You know, I too may have to disappear, because after all, when the Supreme Court decides that I'll have to go to jail for serving bagels, I could become the midnight bageler at the barricades.
I'm surprised you haven't disappeared before now.
Indeed. I feel like I'm disappearing all the time, but I keep noticing myself in the morning. So.
Well, I'm going to have to go.
All right, Tony. Listen, thank you for calling in, and hey, once more, give that number for those who want to contact Fresno Food Not Bombs.
Area code 209-276-0101. Leave a message, I'll call you back, or I'll be home in a couple of days.
And you can talk to Tony, and Tony, hope to get in touch with me too later if you can.
Okay.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you.
And that was a definite blast from the past. Tony Mello, who is a hardworking member of the Santa Cruz Union of the Homeless when it existed back in 1992, and a founder of Food Not Bombs the same year. We have an incoming call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Could you take this off the air?
Yeah, hang on.
I'll talk a little bit.
What?
You turned me in. Am I still on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I would like to say about the book, Nation in Denial, that I consider it utterly unconscionable for anyone to write a book, a report, an essay, or hold the opinion that the socioeconomic situation conditions in the United States are not responsible for the lack of housing and for the lack of jobs, to absolve the political masters of America of any responsibility by attributing homelessness to so-called mental illness, so-called dual diagnosis, drug abuse, alcoholism, is, from my point of view, to demonstrate the either an ignorance nigh unto stupidity of what's really going on in this nation, or the lack of a conscience such that they want really to absolve it, or a naivete that blinds people totally to the truth there is.
Indeed, and I want to actually kind of tell some of the callers have been trying to call in, particularly Brimstone Barbara Riverwoman. Barbara, if you're out there, we have not been trying to shut you off the air. Our phone has just been reconnected. My apologies.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
This is Barbara.
All right, Barbara, I apologize for not being able to get through to you. Here is John. And,
hi, John.
Here, let me put you on directly to John.
Well, no, that's okay. Go ahead. I can hear
him. Okay, so he probably can hear you. But can she can't. Well, you can hear John, too, because you're listening to the radio.
You can hear me, right?
Can you hear John?
I can hear you, John.
Okay.
Okay, good. Well, Barbara, you heard. I didn't hear most of John's criticisms. I was out of the studio, but go ahead. What's your reaction to what he had to say?
Well, first of all, John, I certainly defer to you in terms of experience on the streets and direct experience in the mental health system. And I probably agree with you 100%. I mean, all the work that I'm doing basically focuses on trying to empower people politically. And all of the work that I've done down at the Back 40 and with the River Street refugees is primarily focused on giving people some political voice. And cures and treatments and programs is secondary, and it definitely is not my focus. So I think we're pretty much agreed on that. I don't want to be associated necessarily with this book. I cited the book, and I'd been reading the book, and I actually brought it in that day, because as a relatively newcomer to this field, I am struck by particularly the level of alcoholism and drug abuse among... Now, I say that, and I want to say really quickly that I think in many cases homelessness may be primary and alcoholism and drug abuse may be secondary, either reinforced or caused by the primary condition of homelessness. And that's certainly true. I mean, what you were saying about sleep deprivation, dream interruption, and the other things you pointed out certainly are important. My sense of what that book is, the only point that I think the Nation in Denial is making is descriptive. In other words, what and people who offer very radical analyses of homelessness, a book called Visible Poverty, which argues the very strongly the political, economic, particularly the economic roots of homelessness. I lost my train of thought here.
Could I jump in just a moment?
Why don't you just let me...
Let's have a conversation rather than...
Okay, go ahead.
Well, with regard to your statement that the book is mostly descriptive, I believe you said.
Yeah.
I disagree with you strongly.
I heard what you said about Jonathan Kozol, and I want to read that book, Red Shoe on Our Children. And I haven't even... I mean, if the children are being counted in those numbers, that's absolutely... a distortion of the reality, absolutely.
Right. Well, the most important question with regard to that book is, suppose that what it says is true. I don't agree that it is true.
Mm-hmm. And descriptively, you mean, in terms of
character? No, I'm not talking about descriptive. I mean, what I'm about to say is why I disagree with it being a purely descriptive book, because it offers a solution.
Right,
and the solution it offers is implies forced treatment.
Absolutely, John. And
so that's not a descriptive book.
Well, I mean, it implies that. And judging from the history of the mental health treatment in this country, we have absolutely nothing to look forward to. You're right, and I don't think we need to reinstitutionalization.
So
that's totally not the answer.
Okay,
and
so that's why I say the book is not descriptive. It provides.
Let me
finish this
okay.
statement. It provides for those people who want that solution, mm-hmm. who believe in that solution, ammunition to argue for that solution, and to ignore the. It uses very loaded language against homeless activists. Particularly, Mitch Snyder is attacked viciously in that book.
Right.
In any event, those are my reasons for believing the book is not, or for saying the book is not descriptive.
Okay. The reason I'm calling it I was telling Robert earlier that I'm thinking of the analogy of someone who is knocked down in a road, bleeding. The immediate diagnosis or the immediate treatment is to get that person to a hospital. And if we talk to that person about straightening out the road or putting up stop signs or even, you know, becoming activists on behalf of mass transit rather than cars, he would laugh in our face. I mean, what he needs or she needs is hospital treatment. On some level, I think that's what this book should be saying. If it's not saying that, we have to honestly identify what the immediate needs of the homeless population are. Let me finish, John. That's not to say what the ultimate cause is. The proximate cause may be being hit. The ultimate cause has to do with transportation. The proximate cause, in some cases, with homelessness is drug and alcohol abuse and mental illness, but certainly the ultimate cause is economic. And I really want to make that distinction and not keep arguing against each other when I think most of us agree descriptively that the proximate cause in some cases, I'm not saying in all cases, may be physical illness, physical disability, mental disability, so-called, or drug and alcohol abuse. But saying that in no way, and I don't want to be misunderstood, because I more than anybody is saying that the roots of this whole thing is economic and political, and it lies with large corporations. It lies with the downsizing of the corporations. It lies with the growth of the service industry. It lies with layoffs. It lies with the campaign against unionization. I mean, the roots are much, much deeper, obviously, than
right,
mental illness.
Right.
So if you're going to be quoting me, please quote me correctly. I'm just saying that descriptively, mental illness and drug addiction and other things, and family disaffiliation. I don't agree with you that family disaffiliation isn't an important characteristic of the homeless community. And the people that I've known, there does seem to be loss of family connection. That seems to be a really important thing. But that's not a cause of it either.
Let's have a conversation, and let me say a few words here. First of all, about your analogy about a person, say, knocked down and bleeding in the street and mm-hmm. taken to a hospital. There's a considerable difference between such a person and the emergency situation that exists for them and the subsequent events in their life. When they're patched up, that is to say, sewn up, or the blood is stopped and their limbs are in casts, they're released to the community. The people who are taken in by the psychiatric system may never return. They may be their outcome may be to be in a comatose state as a consequence of being deprived of air for 10 minutes, as was the gentleman over in San Jose named Joseph Leitner, who was taken by the police to the jail and smothered for 10 minutes. He was a so-called mentally ill person. In any event, the point. The analogy that you use lacks a certain, from my point of view, actuality corresponding to what I know to be the case for so-called treatment.
I'd like to turn the conversation to more specific local political strategies, because I think that really is what we're facing here. The controversy often between the two of us, Barbara, has been how hard to push and how loud to shout. I think maybe that's one way of putting it. And certainly reasonable people can disagree on what the best way to proceed is. But I guess my thought is, and I don't know what to do. I mean, I'm just one person. I know a couple people are concerned. Oh, I know many people in the audience are interested. We have a March 15th armory date, which actually is no different than any other date. There are plenty of people out there in the rain tonight that are going to be hassled. There are plenty of people who have been getting tickets. I mean, I've been receiving reports of tickets. So March 15th, the only thing that's special about that date is that's the date when the Winter Armory Shelter opens up. But what can we do to make sure that these bureaucrats who ignored us, who lied to us in the, not the bureaucrats, let's say the Citizens Committee that lied to us in the fall, and you say, well, why harp on that? Well, because they're the major shelter provider, and they're the people that are getting the major sympathetic treatment from the city council is the reason I harp on that. How can we put the city council and the supervisors and the care providers on notice? How can we organize so that we can get this emergency shelter we need as fast as possible?
Well, I agree with you. If we don't have something by March 15th, Robert, we need an action. I mean, I as you know, I was prepared to do civil disobedience on December, whenever that was, 13th, 14th, when we were going to be arrested, and I think there were some other people, including Dan and Michael Sheridan and others, and you,
mm-hmm.
who were ready and willing to be, or at least ready to be arrested. And I talked to, what's his name, that nice officer down there?
Sergeant Crane.
Sergeant Andy Crane,
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that he was going to be arresting me in 4 days. I think there's no question that we have to plan for an action. If incidentally, before I forget about it, there's an action in San Francisco this Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking earlier about the elimination of all the housing in this country, and it's happening on Thursday. The bulldozers are moving into some place in the Presidio. You probably know more about it than I do. And there's a big action led by a lot of churches, and they're planning to do civil disobedience and put their bodies in front of the bulldozers up there.
Oh, it's interesting you should say that, because I have an interview with Ted Gullickson, who's a Homes Not Jails activist in San Francisco. He kind of might give us some background on that, if only I had my tapes in order here. yeah, okay, so that's in San Francisco. Do you have a number people can call?
I don't, but it is. I think it is Ted Gullickson. I don't know. No, I don't think it's Homes Not Jails that's organizing it.
They're probably contributing to it.
You need to get more information from
them. So that's going to be Thursday.
I'm sure they're supporting it.
In San Francisco. Do you know what time?
It's at the Presidio. No, I don't know what time it is.
I was actually
thinking we should get a group of people from here to go up and have a little practice run, huh?
Well, that might not be a bad idea. You know, if you want, you might want to call Free Radio Santa Cruz and announce a caravan on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Or possibly come to one of the meals Monday. I guess Feed the People serves every night around 5 down on the mall, and if it's raining, they serve under the awning of the metro.
What is the Home Not Jails number up there?
Good question.
I'll get it from you later.
I will try to get it to you later, and I'll try to get it out on the air later. For those who want that number and are interested in this demonstration, give me a call at 423-HUFF. And leave a message on my machine. That's, you can call right now. My phone is working, and this phone is working. And Barbara, is there anything more you wanted to add to this? I'm sorry we weren't able to get through to you, and feel free to talk a bit more if you'd like. I do want to be able to get the phone lines open, because I think we probably had a number of calls that didn't get through.
Well, just that SOS right now is sort of working on the tack of,
Save Our Shelter.
Negotiating with the city council, because we've gotten some indication that they're interested, and we're going to be meeting with...
How can SOS negotiate with the city council when it hasn't had a meeting and the main members haven't given you any power?
All right, let's just
negotiate.
Say that Sherry and I are doing it,
okay.
Because at this point,
okay.
there is really no SOS, because
mm-hmm.
we haven't been meeting. You're absolutely right.
Right. I appreciate your candor on that one, Barbara.
Yeah,
no, I have no...
We're busy working with the River Street Refugees, which I know you've criticized us for.
I don't really criticize you for working with the River Street Refugees. I think that's good that you're doing that. I get concerned when that gets done to the exclusion of and in opposition to work that other people are doing. Like when Sherry supports my arrest at the Citizens Committee for the Homeless meeting, I get worried. That upsets me, and I feel that activists should not oppose each other that way.
Well, you're going to have to talk to Sherry on that when you know I didn't.
I've invited her endlessly to come on the show, and she declines to do that. And you know, I mean, you talk to her more than I do. Maybe you can find out what was in her mind and suggest that she's welcome to go public. I don't cut you off. I won't cut her off.
So we're trying to perform this balancing act of, on the one hand, working on the broader issues up at the campground. Also, John, I would love it if we could sit down sometime and you could look at this campground proposal, because the reason we put in those
would
camps...
Would you repeat that?
I would love it if we could sit down sometime and you could look at this campground proposal, because we need people with experience in mental health advocacy. And the reason we put into this proposal the idea of some... And I have no idea whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. This is a second draft at this point. is that some of the people at the campground, the campers themselves, wanted support groups, or said that they, you know, or there's been some movement by some of the camp leaders actually to purge certain elements of the River Street refugees to make it more supportive of others. I don't like that myself, but that was actually a way of responding to expressed needs of some campers for groups of people where they felt that it was difficult for them to move forward if they were burdened by alcoholics, if they were burdened by people who had severe mental problems, and how to put that all together is a mystery to me. So if you have some ideas on that subject,
I'd get together with you sometime on that. My take on it immediately is there's as much prejudice in the so-called homeless population against people with psychiatric labels as in the general population as a whole, and we get treated and mistreated, and wingnut is the usual prevailing epithet hurled at us, and we get used, abused, and the raising the consciousness of people in the so-called homeless community is as big a problem or a bigger work to take on as in the population as a whole. That's my particular drive, is to talk to people about so-called mental illness and trying to get people to relate to people on a narrative level. What's your story? Well, I don't want to hear your story, without, however, pathologizing each other's stories, which is what happens to us when we get called mentally ill.
Right.
The homeless people, whoever they happen to be, who are in the group that you're talking about, from my point of view, they have a right of self-determination. If they choose to have a form of democratic government amongst themselves, which where the majority forms a sort of tyranny over a minority, I don't like that, but I don't know how it could be stopped any more than any other kind of majority-minority tyranny, but that's what it sounds like is happening.
Yeah.
So,
in any event, I'm taking off, and thanks for the conversation, and we'll get together. Robert can give you my number off the air, if that's okay.
Great.
Sure.
Great.
Okay, let me do that, and we're going to have a moment of dead air. And I want to thank you for being on the air. Is there anything you want to conclude with?
Well, let me just say that I personally am, I make a lot of mistakes, and I feel like I'm in the process of learning, and I feel probably everybody is in that position. And it upsets me when I feel that those of us who should be working together are lying in wait for somebody to make a mistake. I certainly think we have to point out each other's errors, but I think we can do that with respect and hopefully work together. And I also think there are lots of different ways of working. One of the issues that's arising now with the River Street refugees is that there are at least four different focuses right now of political work. People have felt empowered out there, and different people are doing different kinds of work. And there are some people who are trying to force other people to prioritize their work rather than respecting the right of each homeless person to work on the tack that they feel is important.
Well, I definitely think we need is all of us to do more outreach to the community on this issue, and the kind of meetings that we were holding in the Veterans Hall, like in December, where we had folks from the Quakers showing up, volunteers from Huff, Food Not Bombs people, again, focusing on the really urgent issue. At that time, the urgent issue was the closing of the campground. We need to do the same thing again, and the urgent issue is it's storming like hell, and nobody's got a legal place to sleep. And, you know, in a way, we could create an urgent issue at any time. If a bunch of us did a demonstration downtown and then we're hassled for it, or you know, if we can get a focus on what's actually happening rather than simply waiting on some bureaucrats to maybe give an okay somewhere down the road to something.
Robert, right now the armory isn't full, so it is, what do you say?
Well, there's still a crisis. There's an illegal situation for hundreds and hundreds of people, regardless of whether the armory is full or not. And I think that that's been the case all winter. I don't think we should be snowed by the Scott Kennedy line on that one, you know.
I mean, personally, I think these shelters are an abomination. I think they're an insult to people. I don't say a place to sleep. I say a place to live.
Right.
Because that's a place to sleep, in my opinion, is not enough to be given a mat and
both
a dirty blanket.
Both of us know what we're talking about. We know what we're talking about. Whether you call it a place to sleep.
Well, you keep talking about a place to sleep, but the truth is that they're going to say there is a place to sleep. The armory's still open. Anybody can get out of the rain.
Shelter providers. No, that's not true. If everybody tried to get out of the rain, there would be four times the number of people that the armory could hold. It is illegal in this county, the city, to sleep outside, and it's affecting people every night. And it's affecting people because there is no legal place, as you put it, for people to live.
So what you're trying to do is get a legal place outside. But they'd still be in the rain then.
Legal place outside in terms of a campground, at least, for a place for people to be. You know, and at least decriminalize the people who are outside. And more important, put a focus on the issue.
I think we need affordable housing. I think that's what we really need. We don't need more shelters. We don't even need a legal place to sleep. We need affordable housing.
But see, what we're working...
I think as homeless advocates, if we're asking for less, mm-hmm. we're not asking for what the homeless themselves want. They don't want a place to sleep. I mean, they don't want that armory. They have a place to sleep, and they're not going into the armory because it's such an abomination.
Right. But we need an end to the attacks on the homeless community here in Santa Cruz, which include the contraction of public spaces. That's what's going on here throughout the winter. That's what's going to be going on in the spring when this pet bureaucratic project community house is set up. I mean, what I want to see is us getting together to focus on an issue fast. And I guess I'm going to continue to work on this through HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and I don't expect, you know, anyone else necessarily to follow my line. I just hope we can all get together and start pushing the issue. You're talking about demonstrations on the 15th if nothing happens. Nothing's going to happen on the 15th, in my opinion. But we have to be ready to do that on the 15th. I think if we start planning on the 15th, we're going to be left behind. So I'm going to encourage people to call you to support the River Street Refugees at 425-5939.
Right. And also there is, I think, going to be a meeting, an SOS meeting, Wednesday the 28th at 7 o'clock.
In the Veterans Hall.
But people should call me at the Veterans Hall, but I have not arranged for the room. So if people are interested in coming to that meeting, please call me.
And that'll be the day after, actually, a very busy day at City Council, when both there'll be the Dan Hopkins appeal of Community House will be considered.
Right, so we'll have lots to talk about.
There'll be a curfew law that'll be enacted by the supervisors on that day.
But primarily we're going to be talking about the proposal and trying to mm-hmm. refine the proposal, get more input into the proposal.
Well, all right, then. I encourage everyone out in the audience who wants to be aware of that date. That's a week from Wednesday on the 29th at the Veterans Hall at 7 p.m. for Save Our Shelters.
Is it the 29th or the 28th?
The 28th, quite right. The 28th, not the 29th. 29th is Thursday. And give a call to Barbara Riverwoman at 425-5939 to firm up that date, just to be sure. And also, if you want to volunteer for HUF in the meantime, I guess Dan Hopkins is out there tabling, concerned about issues of discrimination downtown. I don't think he's out there in the rain at the moment, but he'll be down there, I think, in the near future. Give me a call at 423-HUF, and I'll pass on any messages to Dan. And
Thanks, Robert, for creating this forum for discussion of all these problems.
Hey, keep it going, Barbara.
The place to listen to.
All right,
bye.
Bye-bye.
And this is indeed the forum, your forum, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And, hey, lo and behold, another phone call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yeah, can you take me off the air?
I could take you off the air in about half an hour. On the air right now, I got to take calls. So call me again. I know who you are, and I tried to reach you this morning, but was unable to do so. You weren't there.
Okay.
Yeah, get in touch with me, okay?
Okay.
I'll get back to you.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
And the phone lines are open. The phone line is 427-3772, Free Radio Santa Cruz, the station that will play whatever you say, provided you don't call eight times in a successive one line after another. Now, in the studio, we have a Food Not Bombs volunteer. who's not here in the studio, he insists. Hang on.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I'm calling in response to your program.
Please. Glad to have you call.
Okay. My name is Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
Two things come to mind. First, a lot of the people who are homeless, some of them actually have jobs and are, you know, kind of living in their cars and so on. And,
quite so.
And there's more, as time goes on, we see that there are more and more people who are in these circumstances. I mean, they're not necessarily mentally ill and so on, although many of them may be. But, you know, the point is, housing, a lot of housing just isn't affordable, you know, the way it used to be, say, a few decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
This, in turn, though, has to do with some very specific governmental policies of artificial price supports for housing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in a way, you're never going to solve that aspect of the problem unless you get rid of the artificial price supports for housing, for particularly for home ownership. You know, in fiscal 94, that amounted to $90 billion per year. So it's not a small amount of money that's being used to artificially jack up and keep up the prices of homes, and somebody makes money off of that.
Now, how exactly does this work? Why don't you run the process by us?
Well, well, in fiscal 94, it was, for example, homeowners received $55 billion in mortgage interest deductions.
Mm-hmm.
But I, as a renter, did not receive anything in a deduction from my taxes.
Well, in Santa Cruz, as you know, renters don't count.
Well, over the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's $35 billion for the, or $30 billion for deduction, federal 1040 deduction of local property tax. So that really amounts to shifting that tax onto renters. And $5 billion for the zeroing out of the $125,000 capital gains tax-free sale of your home after age 55. It really amounts, so all this really amounts to a subsidy of $90 billion. You know, this is not a small peanuts here, you know.
What would Neil Coonerty say about this?
Yeah, okay, you know who I am.
No, that's good. Actually, I've read your broadsides in the past. Why don't you sign in for the audience?
Loose Cannon.
You publish a quarterly, an occasional broadside
called Loose Cannon.
Mm-hmm.
So this aspect of it is sort of overlooked, I think, by a lot of people because... For one thing, the people who make the decisions are homeowners, and so they don't really want to talk about the fact that they receive large subsidies. I mean, in other words, it isn't just that Bob Dole receives a subsidy, it's also that Bill Clinton and Mike Reckin and Scott Kennedy receive these massive subsidies, and, you know, Gary Patton, and so they don't really want to talk about some of these things either because they're receiving these subsidies.
Have you attempted to talk to local politicians or bring up this issue locally in public forums?
Well, yes, I have.
What happened when you did?
Usually not to politicians, but I have attended various community political gatherings of certain groups and handed out my literature and so on.
For the benefit of our audience, of course, your story was mentioned in the Metro about a month ago, but
yeah.
But give us a kind of a capsule summary of what happened at the... have you mentioned this on Free Radio Santa Cruz before or not?
No, I haven't.
You want to kind of briefly sketch what happened when you attempted to bring this issue up regarding Habitat for Humanity?
Yeah, Neil Coonerty was... donating some of the percentage of his sales to help the organization called Habitat for Humanity.
Neil Coonerty is the owner of the bookshop Santa Cruz downtown.
Yes, he is, and he had posters in his window, big blue posters, saying, in effect, how generous he was to be helping Habitat for Humanity and so on, and that certain, you know, that if you buy a book from him, you're really helping poor people become homeowners.
And Neil's big with these periodic liberal crusades against Rush Limbaugh and so forth, and then he turns around and bars people from his store who are homeless activists and supports anti-homeless laws downtown. But go ahead.
Yeah. Well, so my point was that Habitat for Humanity is really a kind of scam in the sense that what it does is it guarantees that more people will become homeowners. And the process of guaranteeing that homeowners, you know, continue to wield a absolute political majority, then homeowners, of course, can continue to write the federal tax laws that they do to pay themselves massive subsidies.
Now, how give us some idea. Tell us about Habitat for Humanity for those of us who don't know about it.
Well, they provide what are called interest-free loans to people, and they help people become homeowners who might otherwise not be able to become homeowners.
Don't they also do sweat equity projects where they build houses for homeless people? Or
yeah, people volunteer to do work for...
Carter was a part of this?
Yeah, Jimmy Carter. Yeah, you know quite a bit about it, actually.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. So this sounds good on the surface, but what it really amounts to is who maintains political power and how they use it. And it turns out, I mean, you can see where it goes. I, as a renter, don't get any $90 billion in subsidies, as do homeowners, you know, because there are no renters in Congress, virtually, you see. So helping homeowners, helping more people become homeowners simply means helping homeowners maintain this tyranny against renters.
Now, what are the relative stats of homeowners versus renters? What's the percentages here? You know?
Actually, the percentage technically is about 50% each side. Mm-hmm. But in practice, 70% of the eligible homeowners vote and only about 40-some percent of eligible renters vote. Mm-hmm. So it amounts to a de facto tyranny of absolute political control by homeowners. Mm-hmm. And you don't hear any homeowners complain about this. You don't hear Mike Reckon complain about it, or Marty Wormhout, or Gary Patton, or Bill Clinton. You see, so there's no real criticism of what the political economy here.
Well, what about those who would say to you, but the American dream is to own a home? I mean, don't we all want everybody to be homeowners?
But who pays for it? Why should I, as a renter, pay for your home?
You shouldn't.
Yeah, you see? But I am forced to do that because I pay higher taxes than I would otherwise have to pay in order to support the lower taxes for homeowners so that they can then acquire this home, and then when they grow old, they can sell it into a luxurious retirement, and I can, you know, retire to the gutter
now,
after having paid them all this money so they can be a homeowner.
What was the ultimate outcome of your controversy with Neil Coonerty? Apparently, what you made some amendments to the Habitat for Humanity display he had in his store?
Or? Yeah, I put a little sign on it that I took the phrase Habitat for Humanity and I put across it another phrase that reads Habitat for Homeowners Only. Because that's really the program. It isn't a program for humanity at all. It's a program for people who are homeowners, mm-hmm. so that they can maintain a monopoly of political power.
And he accused you of vandalism because of this?
Yes.
And has he actually filed charges against you?
No, not yet. Not yet.
And but he did bar you from the bookshop.
Yes, he did.
So you and me, we're both barred from that bookshop, you know.
Hey, join the crowd.
Hey. There actually are a number of other people who are also barred from the bookshop for their political views.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, Matsuo, really kind of what Habitat for Humanity does is it facilitates a kind of hypocrisy, because these people can tell themselves that they're helping people, whereas ultimately they're only helping themselves maintain an absolute majority of political power for homeowners. Because if these programs were abolished, including various government programs that help people become homeowners, what would happen is that renters would become an absolute majority, and then they could exercise the same political power and do away with these massive subsidies to homeowners. This, in turn, would lower the price of home ownership, which in turn would lower the price of housing in general, which in turn would lower the price of rents, you see? In other words, by having all these subsidies and by making homes artificially more valuable, it jacks up the price of things to where nobody can afford housing. So there's a kind of paradox here. As housing becomes unaffordable, then there are simply more calls for government subsidies, which in turn makes the housing even more unaffordable. You see, so if you ended these particular kinds of subsidies, the prices of homes would plunge. You know, some people would be jumping out of buildings if they owned a lot of property, but hey, my rent would go down.
Now, what if people want to educate themselves further on this subject? Again, what's your name? Remind me of your name.
My name is Jerry Simpson.
Jerry, how can people, A, get your literature, and B, what books do you recommend that they read?
Well, there are a lot of books on real estate. You can buy any book on real estate and look in the part that's in the chapters that describe the taxes, and they'll at various points admit. They don't phrase it quite the way that I phrase it, but they don't call it subsidy. They call it a deduction, but it's not really a deduction because I, as a renter, am not eligible for a similar deduction, so it really amounts to a subsidy for home ownership.
Mm-hmm. Now, see, your literature, how can you pick that up?
Excuse me?
How can your literature be obtained if people want it?
Oh, the address for it is Post Office Box 457, Felton, California, 95018.
Okay.
And I could actually give them a... I also have a phone number for Loose Cannon.
All right.
That's 477-4144.
477-4144. So any of you who want to talk further with Jerry about this stuff... do give him a call, and you know, maybe at some point we can. I'd really like to talk to you about how long you've been in the community here. How many years?
About 15 years.
So you followed the progress up and down of rent control and so forth.
Yeah, rent control is kind of a bogus, though. It's kind of misleading because what we really need—you'll never have rent control unless you have a majority of renters.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so the rent control is kind of skews the market, the economy of supply and demand anyway, so I'm not sure that's really a good solution. The solution is who has the power to institute various controls and who owns what. Which brings me to the second point I wanted to bring up.
Okay, I'm going to cut you off soon, so go ahead.
Okay, yeah, this is just a I just have a broad general comment, and uh-huh. it's related to this. We don't really have what's called a community. And there is no real community of Santa Cruz. So this is somewhat of a misnomer. And in a way, some of the dialogue here about the homeless is somewhat of a misnomer, too, because what you're talking about is you're not talking about community response. What you're talking about is the response of a bureaucracy to homeless people. So I wanted to just throw that in because this is a general sort of problem that has to do with a lot of other political problems, crime, breakdown in societal fabric, and so on. We don't really live in communities anymore. We live in a particular kind of society which is antithetical to community and even makes community illegal. So I just wanted to throw in that general comment to be contemplated because, you know, somewhere you have to deal with the aspect of community and the lack thereof as a source of a lot of problems and inability to solve those problems, because communities are the ones ultimately who solve problems. That's all I want to put in.
Well put, Jerry.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And our phone lines are again open. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, 427-3772. Entering the studio, we have those two denizens of the deep, and it's getting deeper and deeper out there in the rain. It's Sam I Am and the notorious Michael Sheridan, again, River Street refugees who troop through the mud and the slush to get to the studio here, and they made it. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hi, Sam.
Hello.
And let's see if we can get these mics up. A couple of announcements. You may remember in our last show we had the bizarre case of Judge Kelsey putting a $5,000 bail on activist and video photographer Patrick Lancelin, who was accused of violating a restraining order. We had a kind of a discussion of that from eyewitnesses Becky Johnson and Coral Broom on that issue. He's still in jail, last I heard. He's still been in jail all weekend. His crime was doing what the bailiff up at the juvenile hall told him to do, which is to sit down, I don't know, 100 yards away from this attorney who had gotten a restraining order against him. He hadn't been doing anything remarkably brutal or loud that day. He just, the attorney was trying to fuck with him, and apparently did. Attorneys can fuck with you pretty quickly, pretty easily, and apparently pretty successfully. Anyway, his case comes up tomorrow. On Tuesday, 1 p.m. in Judge Kelly's court. Judge Kelly, Judge Tom Kelly, is the Führer of Courtroom 1 in downtown at the Hall of Justice, as some like to whimsically call it. So 1 o'clock tomorrow, if you show up there for the case of Patrick Lancelin, Lancelin, you can show him support, which says, don't let somebody rot in jail because an attorney wants to put him there. And because he's got some pals among the judges.
Here, look at this, Robert.